You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Charlie Zimmerman. The Klamath River has been getting a lot of attention in the last couple of years with the removal of all four dams amidst ongoing restoration projects. Our guest today is documentary filmmaker, author, and playwright Stephen Most. Stephen has been working to cover the Klamath River restoration for almost 25 years. He released the first edition of his book, River of Renewal, in 2006 and released a documentary film of the same name in 2009. That film has been shown more than 2,000 times on PBS stations around the world and won the title of Best Documentary from the American Indian Film Festival. Stephen joins the JX today to talk about his updated second edition of River of Renewal. Stephen, welcome.
Well, thank you, Charlie. Thank you for having me on.
Of course. So let's start with some background. What is the Klamath Basin?
The Klamath Basin is a 10.5 million acre area in south central Oregon and northern California. It's the third greatest salmon producing river on the west coast after the Columbia and the Sacramento River. And it's Indian country. There are tribes at the headwaters of the Klamath, at the estuary, and also along the major tributary, the Trinity River. It's also an area of national forests, and the Klamath Project, which was the first Bureau of Reclamation project, which drained the what were once large lakes in the Upper Klamath Basin to provide land for farming and ranching.
And who are these native peoples of the Klamath Basin? Which specific tribes are we talking about?
They're the Yurok, who are at the mouth of the Klamath, and the Hoopa along the Trinity River, which flows into the Klamath. And upriver is the Karuk tribe. The Shasta tribe lived on villages that have been covered by the reservoirs that backed up the water blocked by the dams. And the Shasta tribe were subject to a war of extermination, but there are living Shasta descendants who are reconstituting their tribe. And then in the upper basin, there are the Klamath tribes, the Klamath, the Modoc, and the Yahuskin Snake. What's really remarkable about these tribes is that they have a culture that has co-evolved over what must be thousands of years, because they speak languages from distinct language families. So it's as if you had, in a small area, people who spoke French, Chinese, Arabic, and Turkish, who somehow managed to communicate over the centuries and develop an ecologically based way of living that benefits them all.
And what happened to make all these different people speaking all these different languages come to the Klamath Basin? I mean, what's sort of the history of colonization in this area?
Well, I think primarily salmon. What a wonderful food resource that comes back to you every year. And of course, it's not only salmon. The river has steelhead, it has lamprey eel, it has sturgeon. And then the forests are abundant with game and plants for forage and basketry. The upper basin, also in the lakes, had an abundance of fish that in English are called suckers, but in Klamath and Modoc language they're called chwam and kaptu. So there was abundance, but also it's an extraordinarily beautiful area. The mountains of the Klamath, the Klamath Mountains and also the Cascades in the upper basin are extraordinary. And there's, of course, a lot of water. It's a region like the Pacific Northwest generally that provides abundant water. So you have great food, beautiful land, abundant resources. Who wouldn't want to live there?
And I understand that gold was a big part of that too?
Well, now we're talking about a different settlement. Now we're talking about the non-Indians who were attracted to the area during the gold rush. And the Klamath Mountains are actually geologically very similar to the Sierra Nevada. The gold rush is famous in the Sierra Nevada. That's where the gold was discovered. But the gold rush hit the Klamath Basin in a big way, especially upriver of the Trinity River, where the Karuk and Shasta tribes had lived. Yes, that brought in people panning for gold and people who made money off of the miners. And after that, settlers who established towns, including Wairika, and upriver of the Gold Rush country, Klamath Falls, which is the largest town in the area.
And what was the impact on indigenous people from this gold rush?
Well, there were massacres. They were sporadic massacres. But there was a very deliberate war of extermination. It was aimed primarily at the Shasta tribe, so that the only descendants of the people, the Shasta, who lived in the 19th century, are women who cohabited with miners. They could be protected. But there were major massacres of the Shasta, not only in the Klamath Basin, but across the Siskiyou Mountains in southern Oregon. It was a tremendous impact. And in the years following, Indians' children were taken away, made slaves by white families. It was a devastating impact on the tribes.
And what about these early conflicts between preservationists and those who wanted to harvest the resources of the land?
Well, there have been conflicts like that ongoing, and I could name several of them. One really famous conflict in recent decades was between the logging industry and environmentalists, some of whom thought it was a sacrilege to cut even one tree. And of course, science discovered that the old growth forests, which had the largest trees, most valuable commodity for the logging industry, were actually beneficial to many species, including the spotted owl. So that became a very contentious issue, as was the use of herbicides in the forest industry. But there have been resource conflicts throughout the 20th century and into this century over not only trees, but also the extraction of energy by the dams and the extraction of water itself through the Trinity River into the Central Valley and Southern California. And then there have been continuing conflicts over salmon. There was a salmon war that hit the Yuroks in the estuary especially hard, in which federal SWAT teams, Fish and Wildlife agents, tried to prevent Yuroks from gill netting, even after the U.S. Supreme Court had affirmed that they had a right based on having had a reservation to harvest salmon.
I'm speaking with Stephen Most, author of the newly released second edition of River of Renewal, chronicling the history and current developments of the Klamath River and Klamath Basin. And we see the river itself being modified for resource extraction with these dams. So what was the process of these dams being put in the first place, and what was the reasoning behind it?
The dams were not intended to provide flood control. They were hydroelectric dams, and they provided energy largely outside of the Klamath Basin into the grid. The first one was built in the more than 100 years ago, and the most recent one, the lowest one, a dam, was constructed in the 1950s. These were hydro dams, and they had large reservoirs. All but one of them had a reservoir that provided a kind of lakefront property for people in Siskiyou County. But the effect of these dams was to severely harm the salmon fishery. Before the dams went in, there were canneries at the mouth of the Klamath, three canneries, and spring Chinook is the largest, strongest, oiliest, tastiest fish that used to spawn in the upper basin in Oregon. Well, right after the dams came in, at the first dam, that population declined severely. And just to give you an idea, there was a record catch of spring Chinook before the dams came in of 17,000 fish in one day. Well, in this era of the dams, the spring Chinook have been counted in the refugia in the Salmon River, which flows into the Klamath below the dams. And they're counted in the low hundreds every year. The last count of spring Chinook was 115 fish. So the great hope is that with the dams removed, that salmon species will be able to spawn again on hundreds of miles of habitat that are being restored to them. And the really exciting news is that dozens of fish have now been seen above the area where the dams once were, and have even been seen in Oregon so far. So there's real hope for the revival of wild salmon throughout the Klamath Basin.
And what was the significance of the salmon? Like, why is it so important, especially for indigenous people, to get the salmon back?
Salmon are, of course, at the center of their nutrition. So there have been studies that not being able to harvest salmon in any numbers at all, and sometimes not at all, has had a very severe impact on the health of Native people in the Klamath Basin. Beyond that, salmon are at the core of their culture. The word for salmon and the word for eat are the same in both the Yurok and Kuruk languages. They call themselves salmon people. And they have a religion. I'd say it's more than a religion, it's a way of life, called world renewal. And the world renewal ceremonies occur in conjunction with salmon runs, so that when these intertribal gatherings take place, it's during the peak of salmon runs, and the tribes build weirs across the river that last for 10 days during the ceremony. And then the weirs are taken down. So this is ecological wisdom. You want the salmon to be able to get up into their spawning area. This is a kind of ecologically wise religion that the tribes evolved, that is based in large part on the return of salmon every year.
And are there any other fish that are really significant to the tribes of this area?
Well, yes. I referred to the Chon and Kopto in the upper basin, very significant for the Klamath, Modoc, and Yahooskan snake tribes. Those are really on the brink of extinction. The only fish in the upper Klamath Lake are the really old fish. The young ones die of suffocation because of the fertilizer that gets into the lake, especially in the summer. But this is an area of abundance. There are crabs, there are steelhead. The sturgeon are a really nutritious fish. They're really large fish. Lamprey eel are caught. A lot of shellfish are caught within the lower Klamath Basin. It's an abundant source of food, and it's all of great cultural significance.
And we're back. I'm speaking with Stephen Most, author of the newly released second edition of River of Renewal, chronicling the history and current developments of the Klamath River and Klamath Basin. So one thing I was kind of interested in talking about was these fishing conflicts in the 20th century between the authorities and indigenous people who wanted fishing rights. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Well, the Yurok tribe, and this is really significant for the entire Pacific Northwest, won a Supreme Court case in the early 1970s that recognized that they had had a reservation since the 19th century. It's just that flooding drove the federal agents out of it, and California took over. But it had been an Indian reservation all along, and that meant that the Yurok tribe had a right, a constitutional right under treaty, well, a constitutional right having had a reservation, to catch fish in the river. Well, when a tribe has its source of nutrition, has control of that, then they're not as manipulable by the federal government, which can buy off Indian families and put them in positions of power using money. Here's a tribe whose religion and culture and major source of nutrients was based on salmon, and they were still catching salmon, even though the numbers had declined severely. So what happened was that the Fish and Wildlife Service, in concert with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, staged a kind of river war with jet boats attacking Indians who caught salmon. What they did was establish regulations written in Washington, D.C., that had no biological relevance whatsoever, setting times when you could fish, requiring certain kinds of identification on nets. And they set up the Bureau of Indian Offenses as a way of confiscating fish and putting Indians in jail. So this was a conflict that went on, especially during the fall salmon run in September of 1978. And what happened was that the Yuroks, the gillnetting families, resisted this federal invasion. They did protest fishing, which is they put old broken nets into the water, symbolically fishing, just to invite the federal agents to come and confiscate them. A grandmother whose husband had been arrested, whose son had been was the person, Raymond Matz, who won the Supreme Court case, went out in the river wearing her traditional clothes and a basket cap and stood up in the boat and started praying as the agents came to attack her. And what became very clear was that the federal government was not going to intimidate these Indians. So they canceled a much more expensive operation that had been planned for the following year. And in the 1980s, there was a law that restored sovereign government to the Yurok tribe. This, I think, was a very significant event that led to the dam removal, which was completed just this month. Because the first thing that the Yurok tribe did was hire a fishery biologist, Troy Fletcher, as their executive director. And now they have a lot of scientists working for the tribe, including tribal members. And it was a tribal scientist who found that the coho salmon were endangered, and that triggered a biological opinion that the irrigation water in the Bureau of Reclamation land in the headwaters had to be reduced by court order. That event, the loss of their ability to farm in the upper basin, precipitated a series of really tragic events that led eventually to the dam removal. So the reinstatement of the Yurok tribe was a key event, as was the ability of the Klamath tribe, whose land was terminated, to regain their federal recognition also in the 1980s. They too hired scientists who discovered that the species they relied on, the Traminkaptu, were in danger of extinction, and that was also a reason for an irrigation cutoff that severely impacted the farmers of the upper basin.
And to what extent were these like tribal scientists able to actually influence public policy? Like, were they taken seriously?
They were taken seriously because salmon are not only a resource for Indians. There's, of course, sports fishing along the Klamath River, and there's a commercial fishing industry that depends upon the Klamath runs of salmon. In the ocean, different runs of salmon intermingle. So one can't really tell whether salmon comes from the Columbia River, the Sacramento, or the Klamath. So when a species of Klamath salmon is endangered and the management council determines that it's not safe to harvest them in the ocean, that shuts down 700 miles of commercial fishery along the West Coast. However, in spite of the risk to salmon. The Bush administration, the following year, this is 2002, gave the farmers all the water they wanted. They just opened the valves. And they did that because the Senate was divided 50-50, and they hoped to regain a Senate seat by winning the farmers' vote in Oregon. Well, that release of the valves led to a die-off of tens of thousands of spawning salmon in the estuary. It's been estimated at 70,000, maybe even 80,000 fish. That was a tragic event for the tribes. People stood on the riverbank and cried. That's when they resolved to bring the dams down if they possibly could. And what the die-off of spawning salmon meant also was that generations of salmon would never get out into the ocean. And that affected the commercial fishing industry several years later. So these were tragic events that affected everyone in the Klamath Basin and eventually led to resolve to work together to bring down the dams and restore the ecological vitality of the Klamath Basin.
I'm speaking with Stephen Most, author of the newly released second edition of River of Renewal, chronicling the history and current developments of the Klamath River. And this is kind of where you come in at this point in the early 2000s, because one of the first events you describe actually going to for your research project was this 2001 event called the Bucket Brigade. So what happened in that event?
Actually, I was there because I had decided to make a documentary film about the Klamath War in 1978. It was going to be a nice historical film, and we had some research money to get it started. Then all of a sudden, I found out that there was going to be a bucket brigade in Klamath Falls. The farmers and ranchers were convening to protest the fact that their irrigation water had been cut off. So we got our film crew into a van and went to Klamath Falls and saw this really remarkable event in which there were speeches that were then followed by a bucket brigade in which buckets of water were handed hand-to-hand along a mile of Main Street in Klamath Falls until they were brought to a bridge above the river, or actually a bridge above the irrigation canal, and poured into the irrigation canal despite the federal restriction on Klamath River water for farming. And this protest, and there were buckets representing each one of the states, and on each bucket it said, amend the Endangered Species Act. In other words, take economic interests like farming into account and stop restricting our economic interests for the sake of endangered species. What was interesting was that the protest clearly was enthusiastically joined by the farming and ranching community of the Klamath Basin, but it was engineered by anti-environmental propaganda interests. It was publicized widely, and far-right militias joined the farmers, and they broke into the federal head gates and released the valves, released the water by turning the valves in the presence of federal marshals. And this would have continued through 2001. Except for 9/11, once there was a terrorist attack on the United States, the claims by the far right that the government was a malevolent force suddenly receded in face of this national danger of terrorism. So that's what ended the Bucket Brigade and the far right militia actions that had built upon that protest.
And what's next for the Klamath River? So as of now, all four dams are out, but there's still a great deal of work to do to fully restore the river. So what's the next step going to be?
Well, this is going to take generations. This stage, when the dams are out, it's like surgery. You know, your body looks terrible, but eventually you hope you will heal and look okay again. So bulldozers are moving a lot of earth around in the Klamath Basin. The land that was once reservoir land is kind of mucky, but it's being seeded with native plants, and those native plants will attract insects, which will attract birds, and other wildlife will come to restore the land to what it once was. One kind of restoration is that after 2030, these lands that were once in the control of PacifiCorps will revert to Oregon and the state of California. And Governor Newsom of California has pledged that 3,000 acres will go to provide a homeland to the Shasta tribe. As I was saying, the Shasta were the target of a war of extermination in the 19th century. They're going to regain their traditional village sites that were covered by the reservoirs the dams created. I should also say that guiding the watershed restoration that is occurring throughout the Klamath Basin is the world renewal philosophy of the Klamath tribes. This is I referred to the religion, the ceremonies that occurred in conjunction with the salmon runs, but it's also a way of life. It's a philosophy of how to relate to other people, individuals, and groups, which I'm sure developed as these tribes of different language families learned to get along and develop mutually beneficial relations. And it's a practical philosophy of how to fix the world. In fact, fixing the world is the correct term for world renewal. And an example of the need for fixing that the world has is every winter, you're going to have a lot of things move around. You know, there will be boulders blocking salmon streams. Village and ceremonial sites need to be cleared and so that they're conducive for people. Part of world renewal is also cultural fire, which has been revived by the Klamath River tribes. That clears the forests of thick vegetation, which allows game to come through, large mammals, and stimulates the growth of plants for forage and basketry. So, and it also reduces the risk of catastrophic fire, which we've been seeing throughout the West. So restoration is happening on many fronts. It's being guided by what we think of as Western science, but that is no less informed by traditional ecological knowledge, which is the heritage of the tribes that are carrying out the watershed restoration.
Stephen, we have about 1 minute left, so let's wrap up with a bit of good news. On October 16th, just a couple of weeks ago, the first salmon was spotted in the Upper Klamath River in over 100 years. Real quick, what are your thoughts on this very momentous milestone?
Well, first of all, this is something to celebrate. And members of the tribes of the Klamath Basin are sending emails and Facebook posts. This is a source of jubilation. And it gives people hope that salmon will once again be restored in good numbers and that they will come back to the Upper Basin and be a benefit, not only for the tribes, but for the entire West Coast and everyone who loves salmon culturally and nutritiously. It's a great thing.
I've been speaking with author, filmmaker, and playwright Stephen Most about the second edition of his book, River of Renewal. He'll be doing a talk and book signing tonight at 7 p.m. at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland. Stephen, thank you for being my guest on The Exchange.
Thank you so much, Charlie.
You've been listening to the Jefferson Exchange. You can find these programs and more at our website, jeffexchange.org, or you can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts.